Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
You could look at any existing socialist country, if you don't want to call them socialists, call them whatever you want, post-capitalist, whatever, I don't care, call them camels, window shades, doesn't matter, as long as we know the countries we're talking about. You can look at any one of those countries, and you can evaluate them in several ways. One, comparing them to what they had before. And that, to me, is what's very compelling. That's what's so compelling about Cuba, for instance. When I was in Cuba, I was up in the Escambray, which is like the Appalachia of Cuba, very rugged mountains, people very poor, they were. And I said to this campesino, I said, do you like Fidel? And he says, si, with all our souls. I remember his gesture, with all our souls. I said, why? And he pointed to this clinic right up there on the hill, which we had visited. He said, look at that. He said, before the revolution, we never saw a doctor. If someone was seriously ill, it would take 20 people to carry that person. Because you'd go day and night. It would take 2 days to get to the hospital. First, because it was far away, and second, because you couldn't go straight. You couldn't cross the latifundio lands. The boss would kill you. So you had to go like this. And often when we got to the hospital, the person might be dead by the time we got there. Now we have this clinic up here with a full-time doctor. And today, a doctor in Cuba, when you become a doctor, you've got to spend 2 years out in the country. That's your dedication to the people. and a dentist who comes one day a week. And for more serious things, we're not more than 20 minutes away from a larger hospital. That's in the Escambray. He said, that's freedom. We're freer today. We have more life. And I talked to a guy in Havana who says to me, before, all I used to see here in Havana, you call this drab and dull. We see it as a cleaner city. It's true, you got up, the paint is peeling off the walls, but you don't see kids begging in the streets anymore, and you don't see prostitutes. All we said was prostitutes. Prostitution used to be one of the biggest industries. And today, this man is going to night school. He said, I can read. I can read. Do you know what it means to be able to read? Do you know what it means to be able not to read? I remember when I gave my book to my father, I dedicated a book of mine, Power and the Powerless, to my father. I said, to my father with my love. Gave him a copy of the book. He opened it up, looked at that. He'd only gone to the seventh grade. He was a son of an immigrant, a working class Italian. And he opens the book and he starts looking through it and he gets misty-eyed, very misty-eyed. And I thought it's because he was so touched that his son had dedicated a book to him. That wasn't the reason. He looks up to me and says, I can't read this, kid. I said, that's okay, Dad. Neither can the students. I mean, that's not something. I mean, don't worry about that. I wrote it for you. I mean, it's your book, and you don't have to read it. You know, it's a very complicated book, academic book. He says, yeah, I can't read this book. And he just, and the defeat that man felt. That's what illiteracy is about. That's what the joy of literacy programs is. That's why in Nicaragua you got people walking proud now for the first time. They were animals before. They weren't allowed to read. They weren't taught to read. So you compare a country to what it came from with all its imperfections. And those who demand instant perfection, the day after the revolution, they get up and say, are there civil liberties for the fascists? Are they going to be allowed to have their newspapers and their radio program? Are they going to be able to keep all their farms? The passion that some of our liberals feel, the day after the revolution, the passion and concern they feel for the fascists, the civil rights and civil liberties of those fascists who were dumping and destroying and murdering people before. Now the revolution has got to be perfect. It's got to be flawless. Well, that isn't my criteria. My criteria is what happens to those people who couldn't read. What happens to those babies that couldn't eat, that died of hunger? And there, that's why I support revolution. The revolution that feeds the children gets my support. Not blindly, not unqualifiedly. And the Reaganite government that tries to stop that kind of process, that tries to keep those people in poverty and illiteracy and hunger, that gets my undiluted animosity and opposition.
Hello, comrades and friends. This is back in the USSR, and I'm Siegfried. One of my heroes has sadly passed away as of Saturday, January 24th, 2026. A progressive historian, author, scholar with uncompromising principles. You heard him there at the beginning of the program, speaking in Boulder, Colorado on April 15th. 1986, in a talk entitled U.S. Intervention, the Third World, and the USSR. And you heard the passion, the clarity, power in his voice. A voice that, over many decades, inspired many of us to fight for a better world for the people. And I had the pleasure of meeting Michael Parenti personally when I invited him to speak at the University of Guelph back in November 2011, which I followed up with a series of radio interviews over several years. But first, I want to read Vijay Prashad's moving tribute to Michael. Quote, Michael Parenti, 1933 to 2026, died today. He has, as his son Christian said, gone to the great lecture hall in the sky. A socialist from early into his life till the very end, Michael Parenti wrote in a feisty way and spoke bluntly the truths that were not always easy to digest in a wretched capitalist system. He was a fierce critic of imperialist wars and suffered the consequences of this because he could not keep and then hold academic jobs, even in liberal states such as Vermont. The toughest test for all of us came when the USSR collapsed. And it was in this period that Michael Parenti played an important role in the Battle of Ideas, fighting the reactionary Western media and the intellectual cowardice of his peers. His books on Yugoslavia's destruction earned him terrible attacks, which he brushed off as the necessary price you pay in this struggle. In the midst of it all, Michael wrote Black Shirts and Reds, Rational Fascism and the Overthrow of Communism, in 1997. A rebuttal to the anti-Marxist and anti-communist blather that had begun to infect the world. The book remains an essential tool to fight against the ridiculous anti-communist historiography that demeans the great achievements of the workers' movements. He spent the last period of his life within himself, which was a loss for the rest of us. And now his departure leaves us without that anchor which he provided. Michael Parenti, comrade, our red flag dips in your honor. V.J. Prashad, Saturday, January 24th, 2026. I invited Michael Parenti to speak here in Guelph in November 2011, when I was still in the Communist Party of Canada. I got in touch with him on Facebook, believe it or not, and he agreed to come. He spoke at the University of Guelph on November 2nd, 2011, in a talk entitled The Face of Imperialism and the 99% Solution, which is a callback to one of his last books, The Face of Imperialism, as well as the Occupy movement, which had not yet fully died out. He also spoke in Toronto and Hamilton on the same speaking tour, which was one of the last. It was one of the last tours he did in his life. When I tried to invite him again in 2013, he told me that he wasn't touring anymore. By the time Michael came to Guelph, I'd read a lot of his books, Democracy for the Few, Black Shirts and Reds, which VJ just cited above there, and History is Mystery, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And I remember being really nervous when we finally met face to face. I'd never really been in a situation like that before, meeting a favorite author and all. But it was great. I took him to CFRU. I recorded an interview with him, treated him to dinner at the grad lounge, and then he spoke that evening to about 200 people in a packed lecture hall in the basement of the McKinnon building. And, you know, I still remember the fist pump that he gave me when he was about to leave and go back to his hotel. The hotel, which he said was so much better than the one he'd stayed at in Toronto. You know, there was less traffic noise. You know, stuff like that sticks with you. That day was the only time I talked with him in person, though I conducted several telephone interviews with him on various subjects. I'm going to play some excerpts from those interviews and from the talk he gave in Guelph in November 2011. But first, I want to stress that Michael Parenti was not the only one to die on January 24th. Alex Preddy, an ICU nurse, was shot dead on a Minneapolis street by ICE agents, aka Gestapo troops, when he was trying to protect a woman they were beating up on. And it reminded me of when Michael Parenti was beaten bloody by the police at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana campus in 1970 when he tried to stop a garbage truck that was being backed into a group of student protesters engaged in a sit-in. Minneapolis is on fire now. The people have come out in their hundreds of thousands to oppose this brutal and violent occupation of their city, which keeps claiming lives. Plunging temperatures haven't stopped them. And Michael would have supported and marched with these brave people 100%. 100%. Indeed, he dedicated his life to them and their ongoing struggle for dignity and justice, which cuts across decades and centuries and borders and cultures. The struggle for peace, democracy, and socialism is hard and long. But victories are won every day, and the people are feeling their power and taking history into their hands all over the world. And they can't be stopped. In the end, they can't be stopped. You know, we will win. Brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, we will win. Before I play the clip of his talking Guelph, I want to leave you with a quote from the conclusion of his book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, the book that really introduced me to Michael's work. You know, like about 25 years ago now. Quote, "And the people of Rome themselves, they who struggled against all odds with all the fear and courage of ordinary humans, whose names we shall never know, whose blood and tears we shall never see, whose cries of pain and hope we shall never hear, to them we are linked by a past that is never dead nor never really past. And so when the best pages of history are finally written, it will not be by princes, presidents, prime ministers, or pundits, nor even by professors, but by the people themselves. For all their faults and shortcomings, the people are all we have. Indeed, we are they." Rest in power, Michael Parenti. And please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, "But Joe, you're 10 years dead." "I never died," says he. "I never died," says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, "I'm standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge," says Joe, "but I'm dead." Says Joe, "but I'm dead." The copper bosses killed you, Joe. "They shot you, Joe," says I. "Takes more than guns to kill a man," says Joe. "I didn't die," says Joe. "I didn't die." And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, "what they can never kill," went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Okay, so this is Siegfried Berezov, everybody, here on CFRU 93.3 FM, and I'm in the studio here with Michael Parenti, a very noted progressive scholar, written about 20 different books, and he is here with us today. I actually interviewed him on Back in the USSR here in back in the first week of July, it would have been, and so thank you very much, Michael, for coming back to us, coming back with us here.
All right, nice to be here. Siegfried.
Siegfried. Mm-hmm. Indeed. So Michael is going to be talking tonight at the University of Guelph, and this is the first time you've been here, I would assume. So that's going to be happening tonight at 7 o'clock, so this is kind of a preliminary interview we are doing. So I hope to see many people out at that, actually, and it took me a long time to put that together. Me and Drew Garvey have been working nonstop, more or less, since July, more or less. To make this happen, so it's good to know that our efforts have borne fruit, and you are here. So I want to thank you again for taking the time.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to be here, mm-hmm. Siegfried. So
yeah, so first of all, I just really want to fill in, because I mean, there's a lot. I know that Miguel Figueroa said he would probably. Did you actually end up going to the Occupy Toronto? Site yesterday, because I know Miguel, who of course is the for those of you who don't know, Miguel Figueroa is the chairperson of the Communist Party of Canada, and he was running a talk with Michael in Toronto as of last night. That would have been November 1st. So
we decided not to go because they were holding a meeting, I believe, it was downtime for them, so it didn't make any sense to make the trip over there.
Yeah, which is kind of a similar thing in Occupy Guelph. That's kind of why we're not going down there today. But I just really would want your take on the Occupy movement. Of course, like the Occupy movement has, you know, gotten a lot of fanfare recently. Well, I wouldn't say quite fanfare. It's more like certainly the media originally tried to black out of the original event in New York City for the first few weeks it existed, and then it begrudgingly starts to cover it. And then after that, it starts to, you know, try to marginalize the protesters themselves, and like say, you know, they don't know what they're doing. They have absolutely no clue really what they're standing for, and this sort of thing, trying to like, you know, pigeonhole them. So I'm just like wondering what your take on this whole movement
is. Well, you just said it. Yeah. I don't have to say any more.
You don't have to say any more on that.
No, you covered how the media treated it. I mean, for the most common source of media distortion and suppression, I've written in earlier books and times, and I think it's still true, is omission. You just simply do not say anything about the thing. And NPR in the U.S., NPR is National Public Radio, it's out radio. They went 14, 15 days without ever mentioning it. This is the same, and as people brought up again and again with the Tea Party, the tea baggers, they were all over them. 200 Tea Party demonstrators in Washington, and there were about 300 media there, and all saying, oh, here's a major movement. It may take over the Republican Party. It's this, it's that. And you couldn't hear enough about the Tea Party people. They were taking their cues from Fox News also. So So here along came the Occupy Wall Street actually being occupied by large numbers of people for the first time in its history, really. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't find time to even notice it. And then after enough had gotten on the internet and enough people around, enough people kept talking about the oddly strange different coverage or attention level to this protest as opposed to the Tea Party, then they sort of, and a couple of police had to rough up some of the demonstrators and you know, give the taser or spray a couple of young women there, and they finally discovered it and they came in, and that brought them to stage two of distortion, and that was trivialization. I'm going to talk about this tonight. I'll mention. And the trivialization is they came in, and what did they see? They saw knapsacks, and they saw kids with war paint playing on drums. And the clown, remember the clown?
He got
top coverage. There was a guy in the middle, you know, give a clown an audience and he'll clown. And he was dancing around, and they showed that. So this was like a carnival festival, and they talk a festival atmosphere. It's not clear what they even want. It was very clear, actually. The placards and the posters that they put up were actually politically very advanced. They talked about capitalism, and they talked about imperialism, mm-hmm. and they talked about socialism, and they saying all sorts of things about income inequality, and they had that wonderful formula of it's 1% versus us 99%, yeah. which was a brilliant PR, handy little, it said it all in a way,
yeah.
and it should have been said a lot sooner in a way. So, and instead they smirkingly talked about how they didn't know. Well, yeah, if you don't listen to what they're saying and if you don't look at what they've printed and put up, then you can come away as ill-informed as when you first arrived. And the media does do that. What they do is they focus on not the content of the event. They'll do this with strikes, too. They'll never tell you. They'll say the owners have made offers, but the workers are making demands, and they're still locked out, and there's the picket line. And they don't talk about that the strike is about occupational safety, or the strike isn't about wanting more money, but just protecting their benefits, or about hazardous materials. And I mean, they just talk about strikers were out here, and now the police are here now, and then this is, and you get all the stuff about the surface happenings about it, and nothing about the content of it, and then in this case they turned around and said there is no content. These people don't know what they want.
Yeah. So it's and then of course there's the whole attack and destroy the target, which I believe you mentioned in Contrary Notions. I think is where I read that. So if like you know a certain individual, say displeases the establishment, I think the example you gave was a. The guy who broke the story about like the CIA and drug trafficking.
Yes,
right.
That's right. Yeah, his career was just simply shattered, and he was dragged through. He was a Pulitzer nominee, as a matter of fact, or he had won a Pulitzer.
Yeah, he was like a real high profile.
Yeah,
guy. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they just pounced on him, and he eventually committed suicide. Gary,
yeah, it's like it was that bad.
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, he wrote the book, you know, that revealed it all and everything, and he would give talks here and there, but he realized that for the rest of his life he was going to be marginalized.
Yeah, like his blackout.
And, yeah.
Or attempted blackout, like on everything he was going to say.
Right.
Right?
Yes. Well, in the mainstream, yeah. Mm-hmm. So he was consigned to, you know, small campus radio stations, community radio. I know the feeling. So, yeah. So that's what happens. And... But I'd rather speak truth to more limited audiences than speak blather and misconceptions and lies to larger audiences.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of blather, misconceptions, and lies, I mean, I know we talked about a little bit about what was going on in Libya back in July. So I was just wondering, kind of, what your take on things are now. Like, do you think a lot of things we talked about back then, like say. You know, the oil companies kind of wanting in, and like, you know, and the kind of, you know, foreign imperialism, mm-hmm. you know, and its goals and that sort of thing. So it was really played out now.
It's the message. It's yeah. the same message, whether they're invading Grenada or Panama or destroying Yugoslavia and such. They are sending the message that no political movement, no leader, no nation can take an alternative course. No nation can find self-defining, self-developing course to for its own destiny and for its own resources, that the labor, land, and resources and markets and capital of this country should be should belong to that global corporate system that takes over everything. And if you don't do it, we'll find ways to get you. And that includes bombing your country and destroying and murdering the leaders, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
And accusing, what you do is, and again, I'll talk about that tonight. I mean, what you do is you demonize the leader. And once you demonize the leader, this gives you license to bomb his country. And the public thinks, oh, well, we're fighting a humanitarian war. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people in the United States, even on the left, who supposedly, they literally believe that the motive was that the NATO powers were so suddenly concerned that there had been some 100 people killed, although they call it 1,000 slaughtered, that we had to wage a humanitarian war. Well, but there was no evidence.
Like Kosovo.
There was no evidence. Yeah. It was same like Kosovo and Yugoslavia and Milosevic. He didn't kill anybody. I mean, where were the bodies after they took over Kosovo? They said 100,000. Where were the bodies? They couldn't find them.
Don't find it.
The Tremka mines, they said the shafts were filled with bodies. When they got there, there was nothing. Not a belt buckle or a shoe or a piece of human skeleton or anything. It was just pure lies, fabrications. And what's very discouraging is how there are people on the left, the progressive people who believe these stories.
Yeah.
The same people who tell us don't believe the major media and what they say, they were believing the major media.
And what they say.
And what the White House puts out, and don't believe what NATO and the CIA and the Pentagon puts out, but they were believing it. And so this really gives imperialism a free hand to do what it is dedicated to doing, which is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500.
Yeah, well, you see,
the
1%.
It's really a fraction.
A fraction of 1%. Yeah. But I mean, these guys. I mean, it's just I know exactly what you mean with these you know, progressives who nonetheless end up supporting the war effort in some way. I mean, it's just it was just a conversation like back and forth in a Facebook group, Facebook mm-hmm. page, and but it comes through this person like is talking. You know, I must be like a bad man because like I'm actually giving Gaddafi like some credit, mm-hmm. and you know he's talking about like, you know, and as soon as I brought up the whole idea, like, you know, how would you like, you know, if a NATO bomb fell in your house and killed like, you know, say five family members and stuff like that, and he said like, no, in fact that'd be it'd be a lesser evil than living under a tyrant like Gaddafi.
Oh God!
You know, it's stuff like that, right?
Well, the tyrant he did things, tyrannical things, like kick out the oil private British and American oil companies, sell the oil himself, and use that money to build houses for the Libyan people,
mm-hmm.
Where they lived for a minimal rent. In fact, no rent, I think. And he built a healthcare system. He built educational system, all free and available for all the whole Libyan population. He built this wonderful aquifer system, mm-hmm. where the aquifer of the southern Libya, all that precious, fresh, ancient water was brought up to northern Libya for use in the cities and on the farms.
And this is a totally impoverished country, like comes to power in 69.
That's right, yeah. And he did it. And it became the most prosperous country in Africa and even in the Middle East, even more prosperous than Iraq had been.
Yeah.
And he did it all without the IMF. He refused to have the IMF come in.
Mm-hmm.
And these are unforgivable sins. When a leader starts using all these resources and such in labor, and using it in a non-profit way, and for his own common people. That's not the kind of world the plutocracy wants to live in, and that's not the kind of world that they they're going to be building or dedicating themselves to.
Yeah, you can tell us too, because I mean, certainly the demonization went very, very far here. I mean, we get like, you know, say like images of, you know, of his bloodied body getting dragged through the streets and stuff, Gaddafi's body getting dragged through the streets.
Right.
And we're supposed to all feel happy about it, right?
And that was sort of all right.
And some of those gruesome images, like way further than anything, like with Saddam Hussein, you know.
Right.
And, and it's like, and this is like supposed to be like a laudable.
With a bullet hole right over his left eyebrow and another bullet hole in his left temple.
Yeah.
He was executed, right? Point blankly,
Point blank, and then of course the now videos are surfacing showing like the
and one of his sons, another one of his sons was murdered also.
Yeah,
Yeah.
And apparently one of them is still out there and
the third
fighting
one,
back.
Yeah. There are two of them have been killed now, and the third one is trying to get himself handed over to the court so he won't be summarily executed by one of these vigilante mercenary groups. It's very interesting, this so-called rebel group in Libya who suddenly showed up with new weapons, new camouflage uniforms, organization, pay, money, and they
flags.
Executing.
Pre-Gaddafi flags, of course, would show up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
That too.
That's right.
Yeah.
The Ancien Monarchy, the monarchy flags, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of world and that doesn't mean the policy is a failure and it was confused and all mixed up. And now, this is exactly what they want, and that's what's happening.
So, so beyond that, of course, that's a manifestation in Libya, of course, of very violent imperialism opposed from the outside. But certainly, if you get, I know I've made this point on my radio show a number of times, like just imperialism also like affects the people who are inside, you say, the empire. And certainly one of the manifestations of that, not just in the United States, but if we're talking like in Europe with Greece and Italy and Spain and, well, Ireland is too, like, you know, is now facing like, you know, bailouts and, you know, the whole country is like seems to be like, you know, drowning in debt and that sort of thing. So like what, so, you know, that's a form of imperialism as well. I believe I talked to you about back in July. So if you want to speak to that a little bit.
Yes. Well, debt becomes a weapon, a class weapon of the moneyed class. The deeper in debt I can get you, the more impoverished you are, the more you have to pay this debt, the more pressure there is on you to pay it. And the way you pay it is by cutting back on the social wage and the benefits that would normally be won. So they've discovered a way to destroy social democracy in Western Europe. And Canada has had much of the same rollback too, hasn't it?
In many ways, it has. Yeah. Especially with the conservatives in power here now.
Yeah, I know. And I guess in Greece and Italy, people are fighting now to maintain their pensions or the value of their land. What a country usually does when it can't pay its bill or can't pay its debt is it devalues its currency, and that immediately lightens the debt. You're paying it with less. Like a creditor never really wants an inflated currency to get paid off with, and that's what, in effect, you're doing. When you devalue the currency, you inflate it, you know. But they can't do it because they're all using euros. So then the question comes up is, how do we deal with this? And some of the other more prosperous countries are apparently supposed to pick up some of the tab. I don't know. I think the banks should let them go under. In Italy, there's a finance minister. He's really not too bad considering the fact that he works for a slime bag right wing like Berlusconi. He's a member of the Berlusconi government, Tremonte, I think is Giulio Tremonte. He's the Minister of Finance. He said, "Salvate il popolo, non le banche." Save the people, not the banks.
Save the people, not the banks.
That's kind of amazing to hear that from
him.
Wow,
yeah.
I sure wish somebody in the Obama or Harper administrations,
yeah,
would
saying anything
wait,
like that.
In Canada, do you call it the Harper government or
Harper
administration?
Government, right?
Yeah. Okay. The Harper. It'd be nice if Harper or one of his harpies would come out and say something for the people. You know, that would be nice.
Oh yeah. I'm not holding my breath on that, though.
Yeah, you won't hold your breath.
You know, it's like, yeah. But it's sort of like you, like even in back, you write the book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, right? And you're talking about like how people were practically enslaved over debt, right? And like how ancient this whole process is.
Right,
right.
Yes.
Like in about, like, you know, citizens would, of course, be in debt, of course, to the, you know, like your average people, you know, in debt to the landlords or the slumlords or, you know,
to the rich senators. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was like how they exercised control.
Yeah, and Caesar canceled a lot of that debt. Caesar also cut rents in half; they were exorbitant rents, and he also put in edicts to require the landlords who had stolen most of the popular land. He got them to they had to hire half of their workforce had to be free labor because they had all slaves.
You
go out in the Roman countryside and it was empty. There were no more farmers or no more villages. It was just all great plantations with slaves working on them. And they killed them for that.
So it's like he's taking out their method of control, like one of their prime methods of control.
Right, he was trying to.
Actually, multiple methods of control.
Right.
Yeah, so you'd say like that's almost like there's parallels, I guess, between him and Gaddafi in some senses.
Well, there's parallels with dozens and dozens of leaders who have been assassinated, who are still getting assassinated, you know, and killed. Milosevic was on trial, and they say he's on trial in The Hague. He wasn't in the Hague court. He was in this special kangaroo court that was set up by the British and the Americans. The International Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia.
Former Yugoslavia.
That was the name of the court. Yeah. It was a special tribunal. It's still in existence. So Milosevic was on trial, and the case against him went for 2 years. The prosecution kept making this case, kept desperately bringing up witnesses because the witnesses they had were fading away. There was no evidence. At the end of 2 years, one of the jurists, the head jurist, Carla Del Ponte, who was a Swiss, she was an Italian Swiss, she said, we don't have a case against this guy. We really cannot give him a serious penalty.
Yeah.
I mean, they might hold him for a year, 2 years, whatever. But they already had him in jail for 2 years while they were prosecuting him. And it was his, then it was his turn to, to open up his defense. I know I was one of his witnesses that was supposed to come. I was one of the expert witnesses that was on the list of people he was going to call. He had read my book and loved
it
and all that. Yeah.
To Kill a Nation, right?
To Kill a Nation. Mm-hmm. And then he also said 2 weeks before he died, he said several times, they're trying to poison me. And then when he died, an autopsy reported in the press here, the autopsy, the coroner said, he had some kind of substance in his body which was designed to mimic a heart attack. He died of a heart attack.
Wow, yeah. I didn't know this.
And this was his ploy to simulate a heart attack. He would be released and sent to Moscow to be treated by doctors there because there are no doctors in the Netherlands or in all of Western Europe. And this is crazy. And he would once he was in Moscow, he would refuse to come back. They were saying this was his whole plan. So he had taken this substance to simulate a heart attack, and it backfired, and that's how he died. It wasn't a natural heart attack. Now this is very strange because Milosevic knew that if he had a heart attack, they wouldn't send him off to Moscow, where he could live with his wife and be free from any further prosecution. That he was cleverly plotting this kind of thing, and it was so totally, but it raises the question, well, where did this substance come from? And he said he was being poisoned, and they admit they did not have a case against him. And the new head jurist who came in, a man by the name of Patrick Robinson, announced that we're going to have to make a real radical reading of this case. It does not seem to hold together much. So all these charges against Milosevic as being a the last Stalin or whatever the nutty trots were calling him.
Oh, yeah.
And anarchists and code pink
people. Whoever else, right?
And all the others. And the feminists who said he had a general who said, go forth and rape. A general whose name...
Yeah, they don't report anything, any details.
We never found that general. We never found the location. We never found the unit to whom he said it. That kind of story came up in Libya, too, that Gaddafi was handing out Viagra to the Libyan troops so that they can go forth and rape. What are you talking about? Yeah. What a
And that's another thing. One of the things that guy several people I encountered on the internet, they brought that up, and
they believed it.
And they believe it.
They actually believed that story.
I mean, progressive people believing that kind of
You're going to go fight. You're going to go fight a war on Viagra? I don't think so.
What's the deal with that? Right?
It's pathetic. It's really
it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's absolutely pathetic, but it's like they sensationalize it, right? It's like we'll believe it.
Yeah. It's unfortunately dangerous. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you don't abide by rule number one, which is always show skepticism for anything that you hear on the media, And it's hard to keep your guard up all the time.
No, it is.
I mean, I wrote the book on this subject, a book on this subject, and I myself find myself getting roped in and saying, what? Wow, really? Ooh. Then I'm saying, it takes me a while, and then I go, wait a minute,
yeah.
Wait a minute. Is this really true?
Yeah, you know? And it's like everywhere, right? You, right? you hear this everywhere, you see this everywhere, right. You know, it's like everybody's parroting this, so, you know, like what's... That makes it hard to be skeptical.
That's why people who get this community, this campus radio station, should listen to Siegfried at every opportunity they can. That's where they will get the unadulterated truth.
Yeah, that's right. That's back in the USSR, everybody, on every Saturday night starting at 10 p.m.
And on that pat on the back, I think I'll sign off.
I think you'll sign off. Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Right, thank you.
Thank you for coming here. Cheers.
That knows no poverty, a town without pollution. There's a soul with good intentions. There are canyons full of movie stars, churches made of metal. There are mountains made of muscle. We have leaders who are anxious. We have captains not courageous, captains tumbling into madness. But there's a man who makes no enemies, a body never breathless, no ambition ever hopeless. Up on Balaam Bridge, somebody is waiting. Up on Balaam Bridge, I'm shot to heaven. Oh, up on Balaam Bridge, waiting. Locked and shackled neighborhoods, bridge and tunnel diplomats, see the golden ghetto's creeper. Crazy flags for history, songs for the White House gangsters, guns for Hellgate and railway sleepers. But there's a man who makes no enemies, a body never breathless, no ambition ever hopeless. So how stands the city on this winter's night? The city on a hill, so they said. The snow is falling down around the armory, and the city's closing in around my head. Up on Bedlam Bridge, somebody is waiting. Up on Bedlam Bridge, I've shot ahead. I'm shot to heaven. Oh, up on Bedlam Bridge, I'm waiting. Drive the engines harder. I'm shot to heaven.
We can bring it down.
Oh, up on Bedlam Bridge, I'm waiting. Drive, drive, drive.
Drive,
drive.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, paying tribute to Michael Parenti, a progressive author and scholar who died on Saturday at the age of 92. And I talked about how I knew him, how I brought him to Guelph. That was the interview, actually, that we did just before. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. That was we just listened to Midnight Oil with Bedlam Bridge. But before that, we had the interview which I did with Michael Parenti in the CFRU studio. In the CFRU studio on November 2nd, 2011. And before that, we had Paul Robeson, the great Paul Robeson's rendition of the old Union song, Joe Hill, paying tribute to one of the Union movement. One of the Union movement in the U.S.'s greatest martyrs, Joe Hill. So, where do we go from here? I think I want to play another clip from Michael's work before we close out. Something which he talked about quite a lot in his life, a lot of is capitalism and how ruling class interests try to manipulate our perception of this exploitative system in order to get us to buy into it. And by saying things about, like, you know, somehow human nature is compatible with capitalism and it's, like, you know, completely in line with capitalism, when of course, like, this is fantasy, this is made up. And this is, I think this is a good way, place to sign off, is on him debunking, on Michael debunking this myth and ripping it to shreds in the space of about 3 minutes. So I'm going to leave you with that, brothers and sisters. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I will see you next time. Solidarity, and remember Michael. Your spirit lives on.
With the emergence of capitalism, class power and privilege also were justified as manifestations of human nature. People are selfish. Some are go-getters, others are laggards. The system rewards and encourages the creative and the inventive and punishes the slothful and parasitic. But if it's so natural and it's so inevitable, why were the laws rewritten during the 19th century to protect and to arm the privileges of finance capital and industrial capital? I mean, if it was a natural thing that would just play itself out in the free market, why did you need the state? Why did you need to set up eminent domain laws, which were used to wipe out small property owners to the advantage of canal and railroad speculators? Or, as is done today, eminent domain still used to wipe out small property owners to make way for big developers and corporate investors who build their office buildings and shopping malls. Why were labor laws written to deprive workers of any means of self-protection? If it was all natural, everybody in their place, just as Plato said, the carpenter doing his carpentry, why did you need a law that made it a crime for the carpenter to talk to another carpenter and join together to try to better their lives? Why were gun thugs needed, and sheriffs and Pinkerton detectives and company goons and state militia and the U.S. Army used to keep people down? These people who were naturally in their place in this natural system that's part of the natural outgrowth, the ordinary diurnal activity of human nature every day. This civilization built on the gun and the sword and the rope and the whip, this is all perfectly natural, unforced, uncoerced. If it was so uncoerced, why is it a history of the most artificial coercive powers of the state, used repeatedly to give the wealthy every advantage and every predominance, as it's still being used to this day, right now, as we sit here and talk? If it's so natural, then why do they need death squads in El Salvador? If it's so natural to defend that imperialism and defend that natural system of capitalism, then why are people risking their lives against it in many parts of the world? Why use every subterfuge to keep the mass of people down, keep them divided, keep them disfranchised, if they're such laggards and if they're so uninterested in self-betterment? No, they're supposed to be interested in self-betterment. They're supposed to be interested in individual, selfish betterment. I want to better myself. I want to get ahead. Get ahead of what? Get ahead of the others. It's when they do collective self-betterment. It's when they begin to see that their self-interest is an interest of a whole social formation. That's when it becomes unnatural. And that's when we've got to go in there on them.
cops in the Capitol held at dawn. Someone shot him by the railroad. Someone making noise from the center of town. You kick him in the head and you kick him on the down. And you don't serve the people.
When the generator's on, till the cops said move along.